Look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring some films of the film noir genre, as recommended by Kristen Sales, specifically film noirs directed by women. Film noirs? Films noir? And this week's episode, I'll be wrapping up the topic with Jane Campion's 2003 In the Cut. And before I get into it, I just want to say, preface this, that I apologize if you do hear any background noise. I am recording this episode immediately after the very first presidential debate of this election cycle, so you may hear some kind of collateral noise from that, so I'll apologize ahead of time, but I've gotten that out of the way. Now let's get into In the Cut, shall we, which is, of course, Jane Campion's fourth appearance on I Do Movies Badly, which I was going to say is history, except that's not the case, because if you've been with me since the beginning, you'll know that Wong Kar-wai was actually the first and until this month only filmmaker in which I watched and reviewed four films, because of course I had some long delays. Did my Blueberry Nights as sort of an extra bonus episode, but that's not important. What's important is In the Cut, Jane Campion's film, which is, I'm going to say, one of those films that I appreciate more than I like. It's strange and it's surreal, and I knew that there was a reputation, or not even a reputation, but I knew that there was some infamy behind it in the sense of it's you know, Jane Campion's kind of most reviled film. It's kind of looked upon as the film which may have sort of put a nail in the coffin, or at least or started Meg Ryan on the downside of her career. And I just knew it wasn't liked at all. I mean, I think it's something like 36% on Rotten Tomatoes. It has like 5.4 stars out of 10 on IMDb. I just knew that this wasn't well liked of a movie. And so when I hear that, honestly, part of me, well, I can't say this all the time, but I guess if it's a filmmaker or a film which on paper sounds like I could be into it, then I'm always kind of inclined to, you know, be a little bit contrarian, like, oh, everyone hated In the Cut, I bet you I'm gonna love it. And I didn't love it. It's very problematic. It's not a great movie. I'd say it's fine. It's not one that I necessarily recommend. It's one that does some interesting things, but not one that I think in the end is entirely successful. I think I said it already. I've already forgotten how I introduced this episode, but something that I appreciated more than I liked. And I guess what I can get on that is I was actually just telling a friend my thoughts on it, and I guess it was sort of what I said was, I think the idea behind it, or at least what I interpreted to be the idea behind it, or at least what I liked about it, what I saw in it, I liked that idea more than how it was executed. And I think as I was watching In the Cut, I was kind of saying to myself, like, I could see how on paper this could be a standard film noir story, but I can see how on paper this sort of, you know, played like a quintessential, you know, effective thriller or film noir. And I know it was based on a book. I don't know anything about the book, but I know that the novelist helped Jane Campion write the screenplay. But I could kind of see how, okay, I can see how this would at first glance kind of be looked upon as a standard film noir, not necessarily a bad one, but just one like, okay, it's not breaking new ground here, except for the fact that we have a female lead character, that she is our entryway into this world. But you take Jane Campion, who may have seen something in that story and might want to like flesh out something like, ha-ha, Jane Campion's going to be one to make this what seems like a standard story rise above, you know, be something more because of what Jane Campion adds as a filmmaker. And like I said, if what I saw, if that's what Jane Campion adds to it, then I can appreciate it and I can like certain parts of it, but I don't like all of it. And I don't want to say why, because I don't think I can say it, you know, and also who am I to tell Jane Campion how to make a better movie? But it really just does seem like, because, okay, and I guess before I even go on, I should kind of say, this is how I interpreted In the Cut, or this is what I saw from it, or this was at least how I made sense of this movie and how I was able to kind of enjoy or engage this movie. Because, you know, fair warning if you haven't seen it, it's not a long film. It's a little bit under 2 hours, but certainly in regards to or in comparison to Bound or The Hitchhiker, which were really efficient, which really moved the plots along, which really kind of didn't overstay their welcome. In the cut hangs around a little bit, and in the cut, you know, near the end of Act 2 and Act 3, it starts to feel like it's dragging a little bit. And I think that's because, or at least I see it being because of the fact that it is not a script or a story which is necessarily as concerned with the plot and with the genre as much as it is concerned about how the people, how the characters, specifically the Fanny character played by Meg Ryan, how she is responding to the plot, how she is engaging with the plot, how the plot and everything that's happening around her, how it's affecting her. Also, just realizing that I called Meg Ryan's character Fanny, which is funny because I'm immature. It's actually Franny. I apologize for that. I didn't want anyone writing emails or tweeting at me that I was incorrect about that one. So, but yeah, I also don't want people to assume that by saying that, that it's like, okay, so the thing that makes this different from a film noir is that, okay, so you have a woman character, so she's going to be more emotional. Is that what you're saying? That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying instead is you typically have a genre in the film noir genre in which women are sort of, if they're not the femme fatale, then the kind of the support, you know, some type of romantic or love interest for the main male character who is going through this. And so they sort of tend to have, unless they're a somewhat complicated villain, they tend to kind of be one-dimensional characters, you know, who kind of exist to be the unmovable, you know, or unshakable kind of support, romantic or otherwise, or physical, whatever, what have you, for our male character. But if you have a female main character at the heart of the story, then you have to explore everything about her being involved in this. You have to explore what gets her into it. You have to explore how she's responding to it. You have to explore her actions and her emotions. And I think that paying attention to the female character's emotions in here is really what makes In the Cut stand out, or really kind of what makes it unique, what Jane Campion brings out of it, because you have a character, or I guess a character archetype, a character archetype who in a genre standard let me try this one again. You have an archetypical character who typically in this kind of genre is, you just see one dimension of her, but making her the main character, you see more dimensions of her. And so it's kind of, it's not necessarily subverting, but it's also like, okay, this is something new. Let's turn over this leaf. Let's see what's underneath here. And choosing to focus on emotional responses, how someone is feeling about murders and cynicism and distrust of people around her, how she is responding to that, how she chooses to respond to that wisely or otherwise, is really fascinating on the surface of it. Because oftentimes, you know, in these kind of in a genre film like a film noir, you kind of, there's motions that you are typically kind of going through, you know? I mean, the character is kind of expected to get to D by going through B and C first. There's kind of, not necessarily check marks in a way, but there are things that you've come to expect. There are tropes or structures that you kind of expect the film to go through. And Campion, what she seems to do, in my opinion, within the cut, is instead of going, okay, so there was this murder, and then, you know, from this murder we have to get to, you know, suspecting this person, and this the suspecting this person leads to an uncovery of this plot point. There is that stuff there. But instead of that, and this is kind of similar to what she did with Bright Star, to a certain extent, because Bright Star, she didn't focus so much on the actions or the things that happened, but she would instead focus on how people responded to those actions, how people were feeling in the wake of things that would happen. Think about it. In Bright Star, we don't see the Ben Whishaw character. We don't know about his death. We don't see his death. We just see instead the Abbie Cornish character responding to his death. You know, it's sort of like the major plot points are kind of done off screen. The major plot points in the cut are still on screen. You know, we don't see the murders, but we certainly do know that a murder has happened, you know, and we do see the crime scenes afterwards. But camping instead seems to kind of like, okay, so there's a murder happened. Now let's sit down and explore here how this woman is feeling about it, especially the fact that the first murder happened, or the first murder didn't happen in her garden, but the dearticulated head of the victim was found in the garden. So, you know, she's not privy to the crime, but she certainly is introduced to the Malloy character, you know, the Mark Ruffalo character, because of this crime. You know, she's not around to witness the death of her friend Pauline, but she is there after Pauline. We see how that affects her. Campion instead, you know, kind of chooses to focus on, you know, let's focus on the emotional repercussions of these things that are happening around her, which is super interesting to me. You know, like that's an incredible idea, but it also means that you have to kind of set your expectations differently for the kind of movie you're going to see, because this is not going to be bang, 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 like really fast and efficient and with snippy dialogue. Instead, you're going to have scenes where, you know, Franny and Pauline, and let me just make sure that I'm actually, Jennifer Jason Leigh's character is Pauline. I just didn't want to have a repeat of earlier, but instead you have scenes of Pauline and Franny sitting around talking about if Franny wants to have sex with the Malloy character again, or if she wants to see him again, because this is a significant character in her life that has been introduced. Yes, he is a police detective, but he's also a male, and he's also a male in the life of a woman who has not been getting laid very often, who is, you know, kind of, if not confused emotionally, then, you know, hasn't really been, has maybe had her emotions or her desire suppressed too differently. So it's like, it's on one hand, it's kind of terrifying because, like, you are not a suspect, but you as the character are involved in a murder investigation. But it's also kind of confusing and exciting because, like, well, there's a guy in my life now. There's a member of the opposite sex who is interested in me and who I potentially might be interested in as well. And that is really interesting too, that this movie kind of takes the time to kind of be like, okay, there's a lot of shit happening right now, but it's not just all come down to the precinct and talk to me. Some of it is, do you want to go for a drink some night? But, you know, so opening those doors emotionally and open those doors, you know, those doors of vulnerability also leads to fertile ground for those standard film noir tropes to kind of sneak in. Because if she's opening herself to this guy, she's going to be vulnerable, but she's going to have questions about him. And it is great how, you know, there is this idea of cynicism in film noir and this idea of a distrust of authority figures. And so you have that instill the interplay between Malloy and Franny, which is really interesting because Campion does a great job of never really allowing you to fully feel safe in the Malloy character in regards to do we trust him or do we not, until really, I'm going to say, you know, and still close to the very end when you finally see what role he has to play in all this kind of stuff. It really kind of leaves you on edge, and it's really through subtle directing and shooting and editing techniques. And I'm thinking specifically of, there's a scene when Franny is in the back seat of the car with Malloy and his partner Rodriguez, and like Malloy says that it has something to do with like questions about the investigation, but he's not really or at least his questions seem very not on the nose, but it's kind of like these are not deep questions. You know, he should know what her answers are, and then, you know, he keeps kind of almost kind of ignoring her to kind of kibitz and you know. Kibitz. I don't even know if that's a verb. But to banter a little bit and to, you know, swear back and forth with his partner, and his partner seems very kind of flippant and you know, kind of jerky, and so just, and the camera's kind of like handheld, so when it's like in this moving car, it's like bumping up and down a little bit, and it just, there's nothing steady about the shooting in that particular scene. There's nothing stable about it. So, and it just leads to this subtle impression that you can't really trust these guys. And if you can't really trust the cops, if you can't really trust the authority figures, then who is the Franny character supposed to be trusting? You know, she clearly trusts Pauline, her, I guess it's half-sister because it's they share the same father but different mothers, so that would be her half-sister. So she certainly trusts her. But then once again, in standard film noir-like fashion, like Pauline is, I believe, we never actually see her stripping or doing anything. It seems like she is a stripper. At least she lives above a strip club. So I got the impression that she was, so once again, it's these seedy figures in seedy locales, and, you know, the cinematography is very stark. There's always, I won't say it's chiaroscuro, but there always sort of are very harsh shadows. Nothing is ever brightly lit. You never really see, there is one scene when Franny is sitting in the police department, like, after after Pauline has died, I believe it is, and there's a very bright light, you know, not, it's not as though she's like, she's sitting under a light bulb, but there's a light somewhere off in the set, which is just kind of casting her, but she's kind of, her face is overexposed, and she kind of has this deer in the headlights look, and then even then she kind of asks Molloy up front, like, did you murder her? And he doesn't give her an answer. And so then, you know, it's supposed to, I guess what we're supposed to be doing is just thinking like, holy shit, this guy is a killer, right? Like, we can't really trust him. We know that she is infatuated with him. We know that she has a very strong sexual desire to him. But you also have to recognize, like, there's a phrase that I was taught in college by a good friend of mine that she said, when your heart's on fire, you get smoke in your eyes. And how much can we relate to that? You know, I mean, if you're infatuated with someone, if you have a very strong physical attraction to them, you tend to not be objective and you tend to be easily distracted. And Franny kind of has that conflict within her, that she is very attracted to this guy, but she doesn't really know if she can trust him. But she also is never really entirely sure of her own distrust. You know, she's kind of, a lot of the way that this film is shot and edited together is kind of like Franny is stumbling drunk through these scenes. You know, there's a meandering kind of quality to it. And it doesn't really seem to be structured very tightly. Like I said, it kind of goes from point A to point B to point C, but it does it kind of lackadaisically. You know, there's not a whole lot of sense of urgency to it. And I think that does it, you know, that's on purpose, and Campion does that to kind of emulate this idea of someone who is emotionally uncertain, someone who's not sure, you know, was probably very ordered. She is a teacher, after all, so I'm sure that she's very organized, she has a sense of structure, and all of a sudden this murder investigation happens, and this new guy comes into her life, and suddenly she doesn't know what's happening anymore, which is not to say that, oh, of course this woman is distracted by an attractive male that comes into her life. It's, you know, the attractive male didn't come into her life until there was first a murder. You know, they're kind of part and parcel. They're a package deal. This is not a woman who's getting weak in the knees because some guy comes along. But there is a woman who all of a sudden is exploring something new inside of her, and something new which is external, which is this murder as well. And so, like I said, it's you know, all of a sudden, not that her life has been thrown into disarray, but all of a sudden there's something new emotionally and there's something new externally, and you know, how would any of us react? You know, we certainly have an expectation in a film noir film where it's a strong male at the lead who's some type of, maybe he's a private eye, or, you know, he's something where he's assured and he knows how. I'm not doing a very good job here, but, you know, it's just kind of like there's a confidence in what comes next. Which is delightful, and it's wonderful wish fulfillment, and there's some catharsis there, or maybe not even catharsis, but like escapism there. But in all actuality, I mean, you know, I just know if I started being questioned by police because, hey, there was a decapitated body that was found in the, you know, in the bar outside where you know, I don't know how to respond to that. That's not something that I've ever been through before. And if this is also a very attractive, you know, detective who is asking me these questions and expresses some type of, you know, romantic interest in me, well, this is all new. And where does the, you know, where are the boundaries? You know, how do those things blur together? Like, okay, should I be involved with this person even though that she is investigating this murder? And I'm not quite a suspect, but I'm a person of interest. And where... where's the professional and personal lines? Where are they being drawn? And I think that Campion deserves credit for recognizing the fact that in this type of scenario, it wouldn't just be, you know, things wouldn't be cut and dry. There would be blurring because of how emotions and everything, you know, kinds of blends together. And I think it's something that we wouldn't normally expect from a film noir film, and something that we don't necessarily want to see, because while I won't say that it's a bit more realistic, it is certainly recognizing that there would be factors in play that other film noirs, specifically, you know, hard-boiled film noirs from the 1940s and 1950s, they wouldn't necessarily explore these things, but Campion wants to explore them, and so I certainly give her credit for that. And this is, I don't know how this comes into play, but this is a thought that I wanted to kind of talk about, and maybe it's a tangent before I kind of go into something else, but I'm noticing that Campion's a fan of the generous lovers, in the sense of, specifically when it gets down to sex, I'm thinking of the Harvey Keitel character in Piano, and I'm all these characters' names are escaping me, but Harvey Keitel's character from the Piano, and then here Mark Ruffalo's character Malloy in the cut. When it gets down to doing the business, the first thing that happens is these guys go down on their women, and I really appreciate that. Because it's not just, you know, it's not the woman being subservient to the man. It's not just getting right to the main event. It's a guy going down to the woman, him being, you know, he wants to please her. That's something that I really appreciate. I don't know if that works into the larger themes of what I'm talking about, but it's certainly something that I find to be incredibly interesting. This is something that I was going to say. I'm just kind of going over my notes here. So getting back to this idea of after this, that, you know, strange sexual tangent about oral sex, getting back to this idea of things being meandering and sort of surreal and not playing to this, you know, not playing to what we the standard script of what we have for a genre film. I don't think it's any mistake that The Lighthouse is the book that Franny is talking to her students about, and that the lighthouse motif is something that we see, you know, repeatedly throughout the movie. Because I haven't read the book, but I did a quick Wikipedia search today, and The Lighthouse is, from what I understand, it is a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a coming of age book, but it doesn't so much deal in plot as much as it deals with stream of consciousness writing and sort of impressions and feelings, more so than, you know, here's a firm plot and here's a firm story about what happens. I think that's on purpose. You know, Capon is kind of, you know, trying to show her hand in the sense of, like, this is the kind of story that I'm making right now. If you're not on board by the time Meg Ryan, you know, Franny writes The Lighthouse on the chalkboard, then you're not going to be on board for this movie, because it doesn't get any easier than that. You know, it starts out as kind of a film about, like, well, where is she going with this? Like, what is she doing? And if you're asking that in the first 15, 20 minutes, you're going to be asking that for the rest of the movie. Especially considering that the reveal of the villain, who is, of course, you know, Rodriguez, is not a really, like, oh, wow, you know, kind of mind-blowing moment. Sort of like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense. And that gets into, and that comes from the fact that the problems that In the Cut has, and the things that I kind of had wrong with, in the sense of the supporting cast is kind of not even aimless, but, you know, really kind of weak, and they seem kind of pointless. And I'm thinking specifically of the two other, I guess, potential romantic interests are one of Franny's students, which is a guy named, I believe it's Cornelius Webb, and then another guy named John Graham, who is, I was wondering for, like, you know, for half the movie, was like, is that Kevin Bacon? It's got to be Kevin Bacon, even though Kevin Bacon was not credited in the opening credits. But it is, he took an uncredited role for some reason, but it's Kevin Bacon. And so Kevin Bacon is, I believe, John Graham is not an ex of Franny, but they slept together, I believe, two times, and so he's kind of still emotionally hung up and very emotionally unhinged. Whereas Cornelius is a student, and I guess his whole thing is he's teaching her slang that she can use in her next novel. But their relationship is never really fully explained, and it becomes weirdly almost sexual, but not. And you just have these two characters who, I guess their purpose is, they're supposed to be red herrings, getting back to film lore and tropes, or archetypes. I guess they're supposed to be red herrings. I guess they're supposed to be, you know, kind of throw us off the track or make us wonder, like, could either one of these two characters who are close to Franny, could they be the killer? But they can't, because just logistically or logically or narratively, it doesn't make any sense that they would be at the Red Turtle, you know, where the first victim was, like, or at least Cornelius was, but I don't want to, it's not really important to get too much in details, but it doesn't make sense for Cornelius to have been the killer, and it doesn't make sense for John to have been the killer, because he is not connected to any of these people in any way, other than the fact that shortly before we find that Pauline has died, John is like, should I ask Pauline out on a date? And Franny's like, I don't think that she's going to be down for that idea. And then all of a sudden, Pauline's dead. So I guess what these two characters are supposed to be are red herrings. But if you really think about it, they don't make sense as the killers, because their characters have not been fleshed out enough. Their connection to Franny has not been fleshed out enough. In fact, John, I mean, you could probably take John out of this movie. I don't know if this movie suffers at all if you take John out. Maybe you even cut out, you know, 10 minutes and you know, slim this thing down a little bit. It just, and Cornelius's relationship, it doesn't really make sense. So in the end, once you kind of deduce, okay, these guys are kind of useless, then really choice of killers comes down to two people, either Malloy or Rodriguez. And I guess Malloy makes sense, but I don't know. But it, like, when you only have two suspects, either one of those like reveals is not going to be very shocking to you. So it's just the way that Campion and her co-writer, and I believe her name is Susanna Moore. You know what? Why don't I look it up? I got it right here. Yeah, Susanna Moore. Woohoo! Go me. So I guess the way that they build characters around her kind of fails in regards to building up a sufficient, not even a sufficient story, but you have mood and you have tone and you have this idea of this woman emotionally reacting and responding to these events which are around her, which is great, but it becomes to a point where it's a little bit too abstract, where it's almost like the film and Campion and Moore couldn't really commit to the actual plot. And it's almost sort of an afterthought to the emotion that the characters are displaying. And maybe that's good. Maybe that's what you're into. I mean, maybe you're kind of looking for an idea of a film noir that kind of subverts everything, that even subverts its own plot, because it is not as concerned with its plot as much as it is concerned with its characters, which I get that idea, but then if that's what you care about, you have to write better characters, because Franny is interesting, and her relationship with Pauline is interesting, and it's really intriguing for a while that you're kind of wondering, like, what's up with Malloy, and how is this going to affect his relationship with her? That's intriguing, but then outside of those three, because once again, one of those is dead two-thirds of the way into the movie, so then you really just have these two interesting characters. Outside of that, you don't have characters that really make a lot of sense. And this includes, now that I think about it, this includes the Rodriguez character as the killer. I mean, what's the motivation for him killing these characters? And what's his motivation for killing Pauline? You know, it's he has a weird marriage proposal to her after the reveal, but how is that a thing? You know, I guess, and why is he killed? Just his motivations, too, as a villain, there don't seem to be much there. So outside of your, I don't know, I guess I was waiting for these two threads of this plot and these and the emotion, you know, I guess the plot driven and the character driven side. I was kind of waiting for them to converge in a way which was kind of revelatory and sort of blew my mind. I was sort of like, oh my god, this is opening my eyes to so many things now, and that didn't happen. You know, they kind of like, instead of colliding into each other, they kind of just like, you know, brushed by each other, and like they kind of made, you know, were like barely acknowledging each other's existence, but there wasn't really too much of an overlap that I felt was a satisfying conclusion to, you know, what I had just come through. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the supporting cast is not super strong. One thing I did want to note that I maybe should have mentioned this at the very beginning, Campion and her cinematography, Dion Beebe, I believe is how you pronounce his name, wonderful cinematographer. I had looked up some of his stuff, but I know off the top of my head he shot Collateral for Michael Mann, which is an absolutely wonderful movie. I believe Memoirs of a Geisha as well. So this guy knows his stuff. But he chooses the decision to shoot in a lot of the scenes is to have a very shallow focus. Think of, if you watch The Night Of, it's kind of how Steve Zaillian chose to shoot, like, most of his insert shots, like, you know, pretty much half that show is shot in very shallow focus, where if someone steps, like, a, you know, even 6 inches back or 6 inches forward, all of a sudden they're out of focus. And there's a lot of that. There's a very shallow focus, even to the point of there might be shots of, like, Franny's face on the subway or in the backseat of a car, where not even her entire face is in focus. There might be kind of like a spot in her face where there's like a circle of a few inches of diameter where that's in focus, and everything else is out of focus. And it leads to, once again, you know, supplementing that or in addition to that scene that I mentioned, the backseat of the car, it adds to this idea of an uncertainty of what's outside of you. You know, the fact that if you can't even see what's in your peripheral vision, how can you be anything other than paranoid? And so I like that, and it does, like I said, and this is another thing which kind of gets into and highlights and emphasizes the fact that the mood is really cool, and the tone is really cool, and the emotion is really cool, but the plot is just kind of, and I guess also, I don't know, maybe at this time, maybe people were not prepared to see Meg Ryan in a role which is so emotionally and kind of sexually vulnerable. You see her naked, you know, quite a few times, and Sure, Meg Ryan is a very attractive woman, and she looks good without her clothes on. But I wonder if, like, I don't know, I guess in 2003, you know, and people can weigh in on this, I guess was Meg Ryan, I guess, was, like, America's sweetheart at the time. You know, no one kind of wanted to see her. Like, everybody had loved her in, you know, Sleepless in Seattle, and You've Got Mail, and that kind of stuff. So, like, I guess people didn't want to see a Meg Ryan that was emotionally vulnerable, or a Meg Ryan that would sleep with a guy after, you know, a second date. After she got, well, it's not even a second date, she got mugged. You know, who sits in her bed and masturbates at night because she's lonely. You know, I guess maybe people didn't want to see that. I don't know. I've never had any emotional investment in Meg Ryan, you know, so it's not as though I've tracked her career. So seeing this, I'm just kind of thinking, like, she was really good in this. She was really good at playing someone who is a bit more reserved, and, you know, who was really struggling with this idea of opening herself up and being emotional and being in this situation where she was over her head and where she was always distrusting someone. And I know I read that the part was originally written for, or Nicole Kidman originally took the part, but because she was going through a divorce with Tom Cruise, she had to kind of drop out and she stayed on. And I can see Nicole Kidman playing that part, you know? And Meg Ryan even sort of, like, looks like her, but Meg Ryan does a very good job of stepping in and kind of being a part, which is, yeah, something that I haven't seen from Meg Ryan before. But like I said, because I hadn't seen too much, I was not invested in it, and I wasn't disturbed by the fact that I was seeing someone who was vulnerable and who was in touch with her sexuality and what she wanted and how her, I don't want to say how her desire controlled her, but how she was very conscious of her desire and what she wanted. Also, now that I'm thinking about it, what was up with the ice skating flashbacks? And I guess that's where the title comes from in the cut. But I don't know. I guess this was, it was supposed to be tying into, there was some type of, I know the thread was supposed to kind of tie up this idea of not trusting someone. I don't know, because the story is, I mean, the ice skating flashbacks come into play because of her father and how her father met her mother, because her father was engaged to some other woman, but her mother was ice skating around in the small town they live in. He couldn't take his eyes off her, so his fiance left him, and he ended up proposing, you know, to her mother on the spot, you know, 10 minutes into meeting her. And I guess there's something to be said there about not even trusting the people that you love, or realizing that people have different motivations, because there's also something about that, you know, he's been married, you know, 4 other times, and obviously with Pauline being there, that's a spawn from another relationship. So I guess there's something to be said there, and that highlights this idea of not trusting people. But it's just, why were the flashbacks important? Why did they need to be explicitly seen? And then what was the significance of them being, of the twisted ones where it's her, where it's him skating over and cutting off her legs, and then, you know, him skating off the implication of him cutting off her head. What's supposed to be the significance of that? I mean, maybe a further descent into paranoia, but you really don't need that. You don't need that as a thing to point to or to emphasize anything, because Campion was already doing a good job of showing us that there was that descent. So it's just, there are some decisions in this movie that are really strange that I don't know how to really reconcile, and that did affect my viewing and that did affect my enjoyment of it. But having said that, I don't know, this movie seems to be really hated, and I don't know why. And I guess it also comes in conjunction with, I mean, the three movies that I even watched for Campion. Sweetie, I wasn't such a huge fan of, but that was her first film. But yeah, I mean, in comparison to The Piano and Bright Star, I mean, this is a far inferior movie, but it's an interesting movie, and it's something that it seems like she was trying to do something different, and I can appreciate that, even if I don't necessarily like it. So yeah, I don't know, and I didn't go into too much detail in regards to reading negative reviews and why people might not have liked it, but it also does seem kind of strange to me that this was so reviled. And clearly, Campion's career has been able to recover from it, but it doesn't really seem like Meg Ryan's has that much, which is a little bit of a shame, because, yeah, I guess even if people were uncomfortable with what Meg Ryan was doing in this movie, what she was doing was interesting, and what she was doing was very good. And I think that, I think that's pretty much all I have, for In the Cut. Yeah, it was intriguing, and certainly, I guess, sort of not so much a whimper for to end, you know, film one with, but certainly not as strong as the other titles that I have watched. I think if we're, you know, if all said is done, I think The Hitchhiker was probably probably my favorite one of all of these, which is also funny because it was by far the shortest one. But if you haven't seen In the Cut before and you want to get your hands on it, or if you had seen it before and you're like, you know what, that was a really sexy movie, I kind of want to watch again, I got you covered. It's super easy to do. Rental or purchase, it's easy enough to get your hands on both. You can go to Amazon for that. You can go to Google Play. You can go to Vudu. You can go to the PlayStation Store or the Microsoft Store to get your hands on it. You can also watch it on YouTube, but you cannot do it for free, unfortunately, not like Bound. But yeah, it's super easy to get your hands on. I should also say Mark Ruffalo did a great job in this movie too, because I was never sure where his priorities where his priorities were until the very end. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, God, what he brings to the Malloy character of this guy who is just so confident in who he is and just doesn't really give a shit as to how his... It's not even a consideration of how his comments could be interpreted. He's just very upfront. And it comes across as kind of crass. But also kind of like... but bold at the same time. Like, here's a guy who kind of lays it out and, like, this is how it is. And then you have Franny, on the other hand, who is so uncertain about how things are that you can totally get the sense or believe and buy into his idea that, hey, maybe this guy is the bad guy. Mark Ruffalo is doing absolutely wonderful work in this, so I have to say that. All right, so that's In the Cut. That's done with In the Cut, which means that this podcast episode is coming to an end, which means that this month and this theme is coming to an end, which means next week and next month is a new theme. And as you know, next month is October. October means Halloween. Halloween means scary movies. So I have to do something which is tied into that. Last year was awesome because, if you recall, James Cormack came on, talked about David Cronenberg. It was a wonderful month. So I wanted to do something again that was themed by it. So I thought, you know what? Good friend of the show and guest in the past, Gavin Mevious, hasn't been back. So Gavin Mevious is coming back. At the time, I believe when I last had him on, it was primarily the KGB cast. Nowadays, Gavin is primarily working on the Midtown Comics podcast. But Gavin's going to come on and talk to me about Universal classic horror movies. However, there's going to be a little bit of a twist here because everyone has seen Dracula. Everyone has seen, you know, Frankenstein. And a lot of people have seen The Wolfman. Let's make no mistake here. Wolfman is by far, you know, the least popular of those three of them. But everyone kind of knows them, right? Well, everyone may not know, or at least, you know, like, may know but not be so exposed to the fact that there are other Universal classic horror movies, horror monster movies in that collection. And so those are the ones we're going to be talking about, because I haven't seen them. I know that they exist, but I've never gone beyond, you know, the big three, really. So we're going to be doing that. Gavin Mevious from Midtown Comics Podcast is going to be coming back on next week. He's going to be talking to me about some of the, let's say, the supporting players in the Universal monster movie catalog. And I'm pretty excited for that. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So hopefully that you think that's a lot of fun, too. Always curious as to what you have to say. Comments, questions, weird dreams you had. I don't know. Whatever you feel is appropriate. Shoot me a line at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. You can find Facebook on I Do Movies Badly. You can find I Do Movies Badly on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Nolan Fixes Teeth. If you want to get caught up on some back episodes, hop over to iTunes or battleshipretention.com. Go to the podcast drop down menu and everything is right there. So yeah, that does it for In the Cut and for Film Noir. Be sure to tune in next week where I'll be talking to Gavin Mevious about some classic Universal monster movies, and hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.